Pas l'exil, pas même une presqu'île. Ce que tu fais, je l'ai fait. Et entre mille et mille autres méfaits, méfaits à ta guise, tu finiras bien par apprendre qu'il y a plus à donner qu'à prendre. Comme toi, je m'étais bâti des toits d'azur, des rêves sur mesure. La liberté est belle, mais la folie peut saboter sa beauté. Tu n'imagines pas ce que le plaisir peut coûter. Tes escarpins seront toujours de paille si ton prince n'est pas de taille. Tu n'es pas à mon côté quand t'es à mes côtés.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and oh yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning
person's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The new French animated film Phantom Boy teeters on the edge of being a keen observation on the resilience of childhood, but never quite goes over. The Phantom Boy of the title is Leo, a young child with the ability to loose his spirit from the confines of his body, allowing it to roam the streets and towers of a present-day New York at will. He uses this power to help a police detective confined to a wheelchair in a hospital track down and foil the plans of a colorfully disfigured master cyber criminal, Leo being aided in his efforts on the corporeal plane by an intrepid female reporter, who's also a love interest for the detective, of course. The reason why Leo meets the detective is that he's hospitalized, too. He's undergoing chemotherapy, his superpower having manifested itself with the diagnosis of his illness, never specified, but presumably cancer. Where Phantom Boy most captivates is when directors Alain Gagnol and Jean-Louis Felicioli triangulate between the reality of Leo's condition, presented with admirable candor, the sense of liberation his power grants him. The film's most powerful moments come as the disembodied Leo impassively observes his parents comforting each other, and a scene that turns the old children can see things we can't cliché on its head in the most heart-rending way possible, and how that courage then steals him in his crime-fighting exploits. But Phantom Boy is meant above all to be a fun, kid-centric adventure, much in the vein of Gagnol's and Felicioli's previous outing, A Cat in Paris. And so the directors have decided, perhaps more than is absolutely necessary, to go easy on the more emotionally challenging aspects of their story, causing some problems with what is supposed to be an especially affecting moment at the end. But the film, by and large, is fun. The design is beautiful and inventive. 2D world that takes its cue from the skewed perspectives of Chagall, with a bit of Picasso thrown in for the dislocated features of the bad guy. And it is a rush to see contemporary New York transformed into Gagnol's and Felicioli's colorful palette. Phantom Boy could have been more, but it's still a fine adventure. Documentary director Michael Valentine attempts to capture the breadth and width of the comic book industry in comics beyond the comic book pages. That's a pretty tall order, and Valentine gets a bit lost in trying to fulfill it, attacking, as this film does, the history of comic books, spotlighting some of its prominent personalities. Stan Lee is there, of course, Frank Miller, Todd McFarlane, Neil Adams, etc., delving into the evolution of indie publishers, exploring fandom, and addressing the present-day economic struggles the industry is going through. If you haven't been following the field, it is a good overview, if a bit overambitious. If you're already a fan, it is a fun watch, but I'm not sure anything will be revealed that you don't already know. It's making its home video debut next week, and that title, by the way, is spelled C-O-M-I-X, beyond the comic book pages, apparently because no one ever thought anyone would be reviewing this movie on the radio. More focused in its subject matter is Out of Time, Saving the DeLorean Time Machine, which is also out now on home video. Director Steve Concatelli takes us behind the scenes of the restoration of the original DeLorean time machine from the Back to the Future franchise. Time, ironically, has not been kind to the vehicle, and Concatelli ably catalogues the ravages done to it over its life on screen and in theme parks, brings in, as a passionate advocate, one of the people who chaperoned the vehicle in the guise of Doc Brown during its theme park days, and documents the one-year, sometimes emotionally devastating restoration process performed by effects expert Joel Walzer and a largely volunteer team. This, admittedly, is subject matter for a specialized audience, and I, for better or worse, am among those who relished every second watching Walzer and team root through military supply stores and junk shops for just the right replacement wires and meters, and struggling to get the curvature of the aluminum time deflectors just right. Out of Time, Saving the DeLorean Time Machine is nerd porn, frankly. In other words, I loved it immensely. And remember, the Monster Channel is now available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It just doesn't stop. You can watch it by downloading the Monster Channel app on your Roku device or by setting your browser or iOS device to monsterchannel.tv. The Monster Channel. Come scream with us. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
That was his Trump card, you see. The Monster Channel segueing into Trump. I mean, there's something just so appropriate about that. I don't even know where to begin, other than to say hello and good morning. First of all, thank you, Ken Gale, for filling in last week while I was gallivanting, if that's what it is that I do, at ReaderCon. I had a lovely time, and my voice hasn't recovered yet, as you may be able to hear. I went up real early. ReaderCon actually begins like late Thursday evening. But I went up Wednesday because the drive was nice, the day was nice. And then I can spend Thursday during the day bird watching.
It's totally impossible to gallivant and bird watch at the same time. I'm sorry.
I gallivanted too there. And then bird watched after the gallivant.
You gallivant to the birds?
Yeah. And then you stop gallivanting and you stealth around. Actually, you don't have to stealth that much because the birds come to you. And en route, always stop off every year. There's a particular restaurant called the Traveler's Book Restaurant.
Oh, and, appropriate.
And they have books all around, and you can take, for every meal you buy, you can just take 3 books. I more often bring books nowadays and take books from there.
Because you're that kind of person. That's good.
Yeah, I've got books, and you know, people can take them and they circulate that way. But also, they've got birds. They've got great birds there.
I'm not going to get into your bird watching. I was with some bird watchers in India one time. Fascinating.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that would be a great place to do it.
It was fascinating. And, yeah. And South Africa has the ultimate bird watching. I mean,
I would think so. I saw a thing just earlier tonight that involved incredible numbers of falcons that migrate from South Africa to some point in Asia. It is the longest migration of any predator, any raptor, any predatory bird, as opposed to, you know, like a crane or a goose.
It's funny you should bring that up because I've been saying this for years. The falcon is the smartest bird, not because it has the biggest brain or anything like that, but because it has to travel so far, the longest distance, the fastest, that it has to adapt very quickly to what kind of prey, what kind of things it can eat. So therefore, it's the smartest bird.
Well, it stops at a particular point in Africa before it has to make a particular crossing, where just that time of year, flying termites show up. And there are hundreds of thousands of these falcons and millions upon millions of these termites. And the footage that they have on this show, which is on TV, called The Hunt, on BBC America, narrated by David Attenborough at 90, I think he just turned 90 years old, but he still has all of the pee and vinegar in him. And the footage is just impossible to comprehend how amazing it is to see all these peregrine falcons at once. And you're absolutely right. They have to adapt to what they eat each
very
place
quickly
where they go. And they are going across half the world, literally.
Isn't there another falcon that goes from all the way from Canada to all the way to Argentina or something
there
like that?
There are geese that do that.
Not falcons.
Falcon. Mm-hmm. The peregrine is the only raptor, the only predatory bird that makes a trip like that. Otherwise, they are friendlier birds.
Well, how can we
and
only,
hummingbirds
well, how
make
can,
quite
how,
a trip.
How can we only hear about, well, we know about falcons mainly from European cultures and what they call Middle Eastern cultures, let's say Persian cultures. We don't really hear about the African or Indian culture.
Falcons all over New York City.
Oh, I know that. But you understand what I'm saying. When you see films, we're film oriented.
Yeah.
You know, you always see, you know, some guy from the Middle East.
Well,
there's
a movie about a kid living on the central steppes of Asia who has his, actually, I don't think it's a falcon. I think it's a kite, which is very similar to a falcon, you know, training his bird and all of that stuff. And it's a very important passage in a kid's life when he is able to have his bird compete in the community's competition. They all go to planes on the
steps. That's all over the world. In New York, we had the cats that trains pigeons. You know what I mean?
But those pigeons are now being eaten
by falcons.
As a matter of fact, they like pigeons. They like rats.
That's right. Well, flying rats we used to call them.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. But I don't know how we got off on this.
Yeah,
gym,
I'm
fascinated, to tell you the truth. I'm always up for new knowledge, you know.
But there's one thing I do have to tell people, because it is that time of year to see great nature. You don't need it narrated by David Attenborough or anything. There are two websites. One is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and they have a whole bunch of webcams that are there, and a lot of them are good. But the one that just started its annual thing this week, are the West Texas hummingbirds.
And hummingbirds are fascinating.
Hummingbirds are fascinating, and they make a migration to Mexico from the Northeast. And they are so small that they have to start their migration fairly early. So right now...
And they get bigger as they go along?
No. Well, but what they have to do is they have to load up on their nectar. Mm. They have to load up on their sugar water. So there is this sponsor in western Texas, just a little bit east of El Paso, where they put up like a few dozen hummingbird feeders.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put webcams on them.
Hmm.
So where if you have a nice, you know, flat screen TV, I have but a mere 40-inch TV, which...
Yeah, you got to get 52, man. What century are you living in?
Yeah, well, it's an old TV. I'm very happy with it. And it fits into the house very nicely. I can get it through the door. So, but on this 40-inch TV, you can get a 38-inch hummingbird, and watch it. This thing that, now when I was en route to Massachusetts for ReaderCon, there was a hummingbird feeder at this restaurant I was mentioning.
Oh, Lord.
And, you know, right outside the window. And, you know, it really strikes you that these birds are not 3 inches long, that their babies are the size of your thumbnail. The eggs are the size of Tic Tac.
Mm.
But when I watch them on the webcam, they're 40 inches or close.
Aren't you bird lovers so happy with modern technology?
Yes, I am. But the other thing that has little to do with birds is that it's time for the salmon run.
Oh yeah, but
and for that you go to explore.org.
But don't they have to compete with the bears or something like that?
Well, that's what it is. You're watching the bears. You know, there are usually, right now at this moment, it's pure daylight because it's Alaska and southern Alaska maybe, but A, it's 5 hours behind us, and B, sunset there is at about 11 p.m.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you've got another 3 or 4 hours from now till sunset in Alaska.
To turn on your TV and watch the bears beat up on the salmon.
Yeah. Exactly. And they sit there, and there's a whole culture, who gets to sit where, what they eat, how they eat. They don't eat the whole fish. And
really?
So, right. They only eat, get this, the brains, because they have the highest calorie. They eat the skin, and if the fish is a female, they eat the eggs. The rest of it, most of the bear just, well, let float downstream. That's when the gulls and the bald eagles mm-hmm. come in. And all of this is live on camera.
And no human beings to interfere with all this.
Well, the human beings are on a platform overlooking this entire scene. There are about 60 people allowed at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get on a waiting list that takes like 10 years to let you in. And then you have to prove that you're responsible. And then you have to pass bear school.
Oh, I don't want to know about bear school.
Well, bear school is simply what to do when you encounter a bear.
Yeah, kiss your tuchus bye-bye.
No, you just walk away friendly. Like, you do not run. If you run, you're prey. Mm-hmm. If a bear comes into close contact with you, that's when you play dead. And you always carry bear spray.
Mm-hmm.
And bear spray, which will, good for a distance of about 15 feet or so, is just hot peppers.
And I suppose you're not supposed to whistle either. Like,
I don't know about that. Actually, you're supposed to make noise. When I was up with Margot Adler and Celeste Wesson and Paul McIsaac and a couple of other BAI people in the summer of 1977 after the famed or infamed WBAI crisis, we were at Goddard College, which is right outside capital of Vermont, which at the time had a mayor, Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's irrelevant. What was relevant? I'm forgetting my train of thought.
Well, you and Mar, peace and blessings upon our eternal soul. You and Margot and a bunch of other people were trekking because of some bears.
Oh yes, not trekking. The students there grow alfalfa. They're touchy-feely. They put a lot of alfalfa. Today would be kale, but at that time they loved alfalfa. Well, guess
what? Wait a second.
Bears,
they're in Vermont and they're only growing alfalfa? Yeah, tell me another story.
Well, I mean, the burgers they're buying, but the alfalfa they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this whole area downstairs and on ground level where they were growing the alfalfa. Well, guess what? Bears like alfalfa.
Really? So the bears, had like criminal bears?
All
burglar bears?
All bears are criminal by human thought. To bears, it's not criminal at all. You put out food, thank you very much. And all you could do, so we were in this room, and somebody goes around shouting, bear alert, bear alert, and they handed you garbage cans.
And you can bang?
So we would stand there, everybody half asleep, like I am right now, and just bang the garbage cans together, hoping that it would, annoy the bear enough that eventually it would leave. And after about 2 minutes of that noise, it never got up on its hind legs. When it got up on the hind legs,
you stop banging and start going into the garbage can. What are you?
You walk away. You never run. You never run from a bear. Because the moment you run, you are prey.
I got you, man. I don't know why you're telling me all this, because I don't mess with any wild animal.
Well, I've been learning all this, because what happens at explore.org is that about two or three times a week, rangers will come on the webcam and explain. They'll narrate everything that's going on. They'll explain what it is you're watching and all about the grizzly bears that are there.
Mm.
And and all that stuff. So it's pretty fascinating stuff.
What we've heard of, I want to go forget all that stuff. Let's go back. You was missing for a week. Thank you, Ken Gale, again. You know,
yeah.
We love Ken.
Yeah, that's where this all happened. Cause I was
because you was doing what? You was hanging out with some writers? You were doing what?
Writers and readers. It's called ReaderCon.
ReaderCon.
Yeah, ReaderCon, which the
did they exist before that Comic-Con or whatever that is?
Yes, well before. ReaderCon, this is the 26th annual ReaderCon. WorldCons are in their 77th, 78th year. Comic-Con began as a comic book convention somewhere either in the late 60s or early 70s.
But ReaderCon's been going on. So
But the point is, Comic-Con has nothing to do with comics.
I got you. Yeah, they're just fan people or whatever.
They're not even fan people. It's Hollywood. It's where Hollywood debuts movies and TV shows, and people go to see actors.
So they got you're not saying they got hijacked by Hollywood. You say Hollywood started it? What do you say?
No. Hollywood co-opted it.
Co-opted it. Okay, they did get hijacked.
Yeah, there is the con within the con. If you are a comic book person, and soon I will have one of the biggest names. Well, Ken Gale always has the biggest names in comic books, so when he hosts my show. But I'll have Chris Claremont, who was the writer of X-Men for like 20 years. He'll be coming back on the show soon because he's got a new novel out.
Oh, okay.
And whenever Chris writes,
let's go back to this ReaderCon. So
ReaderCon.
So do you have a lot of cleavage in ReaderCon? What do you have? You have
not a lot of spaced out people. Not as much. ReaderCon is first of all a very multicultural con, more so than many.
Because they're they're writers and readers, of course.
Yeah. Writers and readers, yes, but writers and readers don't. You know, a lot of writers are reactionary and stuff like that. Mm. There are any number of writers who are very much on the wrong side of the kind of politics that are practiced at WBAI. But having said that, ReaderCon tends to lean itself the other way. It tends to be more progressive. But the point is that
if you
go to most science fiction conventions, there will be Star Trek. There will be Star Wars. More importantly, there'll be Doctor Who and, fun shows.
Well, I don't want to get into that. I'm actually interviewing you about ReaderCon. Because I want to know about ReaderCon.
Okay.
I'm just saying, well, what attracts you to ReaderCon?
ReaderCon's rather unique.
That's what I'm asking you. What makes it unique and why, if Jim Freund hangs out at ReaderCon, it must be something to it. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, there was a year when I attended over 30 cons easily. Yeah,
30 cons?
Easily.
30?
Yeah.
What was you doing in your life? Never mind.
Working at WBAI and producing radio shows about science fiction, and I would interview people there. And this is where I know my community from. This is why I'm able to run the reading series that I do and know the people that I do, is because this subculture.
But I listen to your readers. I get some of your readers. Well, I get some of your stuff online. You know, because I actually do. But you mentioned something that's very important.
And we should mention to listeners that Anthony lives in South Africa.
Yeah, that's true. But more importantly than that, remember, this is a community radio station.
Yeah.
And to be, by definition, you have to be a part of a community. So what I'm suggesting is that by you going to all these cons, Durant, Wisconsin, that is your community.
Yeah.
And that's what you basically bring to the airwaves.
Yeah.
Is community.
Community of science fiction fandom. Word fandom comes from science fiction, as it actually is a combination of science fiction and baseball. That word was coined for baseball and science fiction. There is a great deal that is common in today's jargon and usage of American language and stuff, and things that people are using that all come out of science fiction fandom. The, smileys the whole thing that people call emoji. We've been using these for...
But I just smiley with some invention by this dentist or something like that. That's what they say. This
nonsense.
That's nonsense. Oh,
nonsense.
Okay. Well, give me the history of smiley. This has got to be important.
It's no big deal. Zines.
I know zines. Yeah.
Zines that come out of science fiction from... Ray Bradbury started by writing letters of comment to zines that were run by people in the 1940s. And if you wanted to indicate that you were saying something that sounded serious but was not, but was supposed to be sarcastic or sardonic, you did a colon and a dash and an end parent, and that was a smiley, because you're doing everything pretty much on mimeograph.
Yes, yes.
You have nothing but a typewriter. You don't have a computer. You're doing this all by typewriter and stencil. And so there was a whole thing of art that was created through that. But the smiley, the basic smiley and the winky and the various things, I mean, these go back. Maybe there was a dentist who was in science fiction fandom who was joining this thing. But there are zines that go back 50 years or more. In fact, I'll say more, because 50 years isn't that old. Star Trek, as of September, is 50 years old. So let's make it 70 years that smileys go back. So if this dentist was doing it 70 years ago, I'll buy that person was, usurped by fandom or something like that.
Well, Jim Fraun, you're a fount of information, which is why we listen to the radio.
Hopefully.
Why we listen to WBAI. No, yeah. I'm serious. I'm not trying to stroke you.
WBAI New York.
That's where we are.
It's 2 a.m.
Is it?
Where does the time go? That was a station.
We better start running our mouths and do something else. I don't know. We have a lot. We could talk. We're radio people. We could talk forever.
Yeah, and we do. And we do. I need to bring up some music. Just have it in hand, in preparation, so that we can do that thing that we were talking about. So, and this actually requires a good amount of coordination on my part.
Sit up. Well, but you're coordinated. You're a radio man. Radio people can do anything. I believe in radio people.
But we have to do that without... Let's see. So now I have to sign in. And in order to sign in, there's all this stuff you got to do.
Oh, well. Well, look, by the way, since we are WBAI and all the rest of that other good stuff, I just want to remind folks. I just have to remind folks. It's just my obligation, my duty, and that is that we are coming up on, once again, support season. Support season.
It's always support season at WBAI.
See, now, aren't you doing something?
I am.
Pay attention to what you're doing. I'm talking to the people. I'm not talking to you. We're coming up on support season. That means that basically, I don't know, next week, Monday, Tuesday, something like that, you're going to have to show some support. Now, you don't have to, but we would like you to show some support. I just thought I'd mention that. I'm not going to be involved because I'm flying back to South Africa.
To avoid all this.
It's interesting. No, I just have to say this. I started at WBAI by being a telephone volunteer during support season. and I sort of weirdly miss... when we had this whole communal thing where people would come and, get a little... We didn't start by feeding people. We just would come and show support, answer phones or whatever have you. Every time I could, even when I left, when I was traveling the world, when I would come back and if there was a membership drive going on, I would come and person the phones. I have to be politically correct with that. And person the phones. I mean, it's just one of the things. I never stopped personing the phones. But now, I don't person the phones anymore. That's history now. I don't person the phones anymore because there is no phones to person.
Well, so, in theory, that's supposed to come back.
Really?
In theory, currently we outsource all of that.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But, it will happen that
I believe
should we survive at all in any way, shape, or form, There'll be people in the front room where you and I were.
Oh, yeah.
They'll actually be answering the phones again. And that would be very nice if we had that.
Yeah, I miss that community feeling.
Yeah, know? Exactly. And it's that thing that began the radio careers of so many of us.
Yeah. I mean, I went through the whole thing. First, I was a volunteer. Then I helped somebody. I helped Bernard White do Emanations when he was on it at night, because he started in the afternoon, I think. Anyway, when he was on at night, I used to help him. I think it was a Tuesday or something like that, or Wednesday, something like that. I think it was a Tuesday. I helped
Emanations,
him.
Right.
Yeah. I used to put the records back in the sleeves for him, you know?
Yeah, right. People do.
And I started. That's how I started, you know. And then I also did some vox pop for him. That's how I really started vox pop for shows. Mm-hmm. And then it went on from there. Yeah, it's engineering and blah 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 and all this and a lot of things. I did everything at WBA, including train people.
Yeah, well, that is in the olden days.
Yeah.
I was discussing this just last night with our esteemed station manager, how I always had this belief that before you were allowed on the air, you should work for the station for a month. You should do a month's worth of work for the good of WBAI, whether it's answering phones, scrubbing out water bottles, I don't care what. But show that you are here for the radio station and not just because the radio station gives you a soapbox.
Yeah, but the other thing is called legacy. But I just a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, I was hanging out with Underground Railroad, and they're coming up on their 25th anniversary in September.
Another bunch of newbies, yeah.
And then, but more importantly than that, Creative Unity is coming up on their 30th anniversary.
Yep.
So I'm responsible for both those programs. I don't know what.
Oh, are you? Okay.
Yeah, you didn't know that. You knew that. No,
I've forgotten it.
When I came in, there was diversely. There was just no. There wasn't.
Remember, I'm a late night person. Always have been.
No, I made a deal with Creative Unity. I used to be an artist model for a School of Visual Arts, where Creative Unity was at, and they were doing some stuff. And I said to them, I said, you know, what you're doing is great, but you know, because you're doing it, but you're using all these voices, but you know, you'd be better on radio. So I somehow finagled and made a deal, because they still had the folio there, and they were art students.
Yeah.
So I got them a gig to do the folio, but in turn I would train them in radio. And so I trained them in radio. And believe it or not, they had a show on the air before I had a show on the air.
Yeah. Well, this is also in the day when a department head, or for that matter, a producer, might not be on the air. I mean, there were any number of shows that I produced that I was never heard on. And that's, you know, the word producer does not mean
that you're.
And in fact, in commercial radio, the producer of a show is never
on the air.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting system, because you know how my first program was, because, you know who put me on? Rick Harris.
Yeah.
And Tom Whisker put me on the air. Because Tom Whisker had to take a break to do something. He was doing some sort of weaponry, I don't know, lecture series for 6 weeks or whatever. I think it was like 6 weeks. And they wanted
some kind of stuff he's been doing of late, I guess.
Anyway, but they wanted somebody to take his spot for 6 weeks. So they approached me. I said, look, I don't do any. I'm sorry, I don't do that. They said, no, we've been watching you. You can do whatever you want. In fact, we don't want you to do weaponry. Just do whatever you want. So I did this.
It's called Freeform, yeah.
That's what it was. And so I did this. My first program was called Livewire, Tony Sloan on the Radio. And it was wild. It was totally wild. Because I took one of the Creative Unity guys before they was on the air, Gilbert Giles, and he was doing a painting in one room, and I was doing something in another room. And I would run to the other one put the microphone on, and we'd talk about his painting and whatever it is, run back. You know, it was a wild show. It was a crazy show.
Yeah.
I wish I had tapes of that show. But it was only for 6 weeks, you know, and then blah, blah, blah. Things happened. Da, 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 da. Anyway, I went.
Yeah, we also, in those days, took a more view of radio as a transient medium. That when the show was over, it was gone. And now, of course.
Yes. No, that's very important. Because the reason why I was so attracted because I'm a theater person. And for me, a theater production is a theater production. You're done. Even my first, actually, my first real live audio drama was a thing called Day of Absence, where I actually used the entire station to do Day of Absence.
Mm-hmm.
I used all the studios because my idea was that the different stations, the different areas, you know, with the main control room, the meat locker, the studio A. I even mic'd up the air conditioned room.
So we're talking about 505
Yeah, 505, yeah. And 35th Street. But I used the microphone as if there were lights coming up on a stage, you know, so you would come up, like if you wanted to light up the kitchen, you just light up the kitchen, you have the action there, but you would still see the living room wherever it is until you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was my idea. And I remember the first engineer, I'm not going to mention who she was, she says, "We can't do this." And I said, "Oh." So I had to do it. I had to engineer myself. You know what I mean? Because I'm always, this. And then they said, wow. It was, I had blocked off. It was the middle of the day, so I had blocked off the hallways. And people, what's going on? It was great. To this day, I think that was maybe the best for me personally. It was like the best because of all the elements.
My favorite, we weren't quite as adventuresome, but in the earliest days of Hour of the Wolf, when Margot Adler was still presiding over the program, 5 to 7 a.m., we took cables long enough to be able to go and sit out of the steps of the church. BAI used to own a building. It was an ex-church on 62nd Street near First Avenue.
I visited that one time.
And we sat on the steps of the church and read a story aloud. And invited people to drive by, mainly cab drivers would drive by, and read a few paragraphs from that short story.
Oh, I would love to do that.
And the name of the short story was "The Big Flash" by Norman Spinrad.
Oh man, we used to hang some microphones out the window here on Atlantic Avenue. Come on.
We need to do that. I mean, at least we have a fabulous space downstairs that the station still has to learn how to leverage. Lister? Is that a Lister out there? All I saw was a hand. Lister. Okay.
One of the things I wanted to know. No, I don't think so.
Anthony, meet Lister.
Hey, man.
Lister, meet Anthony.
Oh, you forgive my hand there.
This guy used to be our arts director. Can you imagine?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, you can you? Okay. And everybody needs to stay tuned for 3 a.m. for Burn Baby Burn Clappers.
Okay.
With Lister coming your way. This guy was like the executive record producer of Island Records.
Oh, really?
In Haiti.
In Haiti. Did you know a guy in England named Leroy Jenkins? Yeah, but he was in England. He did the first Madiba. He was one of the producers behind the Madiba concert that they had in England. You know, that the Island Records put on. You know, well, it doesn't matter. Is Leroy's last name? I forgot what Leroy's last name is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I mean, this cat is. He's like you.
Jones. Says, Leroy Jones.
Not Leroy Jones.
Not.
Okay. Nice to meet you, Lister.
So, he's not going to leave the room. You know,
So what I was saying, but one of the interesting things I was at the church one time, not as a producer, but Pepsi Charles had a program, and she was interviewing County Cullen's wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now he had passed, of course.
I not engineering at that time? I was usually her engineer.
I don't remember.
I was chief announcer in those days.
I think she was engineering her own show by then, because I just remember those two. And I was so I was so enamored with County Cullen, you know. Rain.
Chief announcer took away the ability of her to engineer her own show.
So
that was me.
Well, I didn't know Pepsi did her own show. That was my first.
And that's how I met Miles Davis.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, he was on Pepsi show?
He was.
Really?
He was.
Chaka Khan was on Pepsi show. Chaka Khan wanted to do with DJ.
That I don't remember.
That was later at 505.
No, this is at the church. I remember meeting Miles Davis, and I got my autographs on my albums.
Hey, we got
my autograph from Bitches Brew.
We have a lot of stories here, you know, but We can talk
after
forever.
This many years. My 50th anniversary of WBAI is next May.
Really?
Yeah.
So you was a youngin' when you first came.
I was 13.
That beats it all. Would you run away from home?
Well, sort of.
Oh, okay, I won't.
I certainly dropped out of school.
We won't get into it.
But I was by the time that wasn't the church yet, but by the time we were in the church, I was pretty much living in the balcony of the church for 3 years. I would go home for showers and changes of clothes, and to assure my parents I wasn't dead. But for the most part, yeah,
But they let you hang.
Yeah.
Where were you living at? Where were your parents living at?
In Queens.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. So you was like...
I could walk to the station in 2 hours. You know, it wasn't that bad. But I could take my scooter, and by that I don't mean a motor scooter. I mean a scooter that you pedal. And that would take me maybe a little under an hour.
The old
or I could take the bus.
You take the old skates and put it on some wood?
No. This is a... This is
That's
an air...
Scooter.
It's not like the crappy scooters they got today. This was an air tire scooter with brakes that... they're nothing like the little junky things that you see today.
So you was like the guy from Saturday Night Live and went over the bridge to the big city.
Well, I don't know about Saturday Night Live, but I went over the 59th Street Bridge. And BAI was right on the other side of that bridge.
But, you know, the 59th Street Bridge is quite interesting because, you know, they had Welfare Island right down, well, they call it Roosevelt Island now. But my mother was hospitalized at Goldwater Memorial Hospital at Welfare Island. So I used to have to go there and go down that elevator, wherever that was.
Yeah, right, what I called the upside down building, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I went down that once.
And know who her nurse was? Alberta Hunter was one of her nurses.
Oh, my God.
Talk about full circle jazz and everything like that.
Yeah, really?
Really? Alberta Hunter. In fact, when finally Alberta Hunter retired, and then she played at the Cookery. I went and saw her at the Cookery with Hubie Blake on piano.
There was somebody I know is actually a relative to my partner, and she's a nurse and. The BAI connection comes up, and she turned out to be nurse to Simon Lokley's father.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, in this small, small world.
Oh, peace and blessings to Simon Lokley's. I was sad to hear about Simon Lokley's passing.
Well, sad is hardly the word. The last 2 years have been very cruel to the station.
Well, people getting old.
Between Ibrahim Gonzalez and... These weren't old people.
That's
you
true.
Know,
well,
you
this,
know,
well,
Margo was 67.
You know I brought Ibrahim to the station?
Yeah, that I knew. That I knew. Yeah. He would certainly mention that. So there's Ibrahim. I think he started the horrible wave of loss that we were experiencing in the staff. And there have been...
That's why you have to rejuvenate, man. You're supposed to rejuvenate.
That's the deal. And I think that if we rejuvenate, we'll rejuvenate the audience.
You still have the satellite on.
The current IPD, the current interim program director, is bringing in some new people. She's causing some rejuvenation. Jeannie Hopper.
Who I brought to the station?
But
you know, we're not supposed to talk about the station, but I have to say, there's one big complaint I have. I hate it. It's against all kinds of sensibilities. You cannot bring somebody to the station. One, like you say, they not do something for the station before they get on the air. But two, you never name your show after your name. This is not a branding station. You have to be creative enough to find a name for your show. It's as simple as that. So I will protest. I should come out here and toy.
There are a few people. There are a few.
No, they
people.
They need to change. They need
just
to just
have
right now.
My
just
name the, show.
Just I'm sorry. Just change it. Get rid of that. Done. Sorry. We're not a commercial station.
Yes,
this is not your diving platform to go on to bigger and better.
Margot worked her brain hard to come up with Hour of the Wolf, and then saw the movie by Ingmar Bergman.
Mm.
And from that movie, she named the show.
Well, I worked very hard to come up with Nomo Radio.
Yeah.
I mean, very hard. You know, it has a lot to do with with theater. Has a lot to do with African sensibilities. It has a lot to do with a lot of things. People think I'm saying No More Radio, which I love, but this is Nomo Radio. As simple as that, you know.
When you started at BAI, how often had you been in Africa? What was your experience with Africa at that time? And why is it your home today?
Well, When I started BAI, I had never traveled outside the United States.
That was my impression.
I have to go all the way back to when I was in the Air Force. In 1973, I had an opportunity either to go to California or to go to, Ethiopia.
Mm.
Now, that's a no-brainer, go to Ethiopia.
Yeah.
But something said, no, go to California, because...
Food's better in Ethiopia.
Sure. But I think the reason why I didn't go was because... Well, I know the reason why I didn't go. First of all, I do spiritual things. I do what the path leads me to. I think that if I would have went then, I would have kept on traveling then.
Right.
It wasn't even a conscious thing. That's what happened. But my first official trip out of the United States was in 1988, I think it was. And when I went for my birthday, I went to the jazz festival up in Montreal, which I dearly love.
Yeah.
In Canada. That was my first official trip. Then shortly after that, in 1989, went to Panama on this trip. In fact, that's the trip that, well, Jeannie was on that trip, but also that's where Robert Knight won his Polk Award, because he broke off from the group and interviewed Noriega, you know, and then, which is, oh, this is another great story. After that trip, about a week or two after that trip, then when they invaded and to take out Noriega,
yeah.
Since I had just come back, I got to tell you this story. This is amazing. This is a BAI story. For some reason, I was at the station in the middle of the night.
By the way, I just have to tell listeners, we are going to get to some...
Oh, yeah.
We'll call it genre stuff in a little while.
Yeah, it's genre.
It is genre. Yeah. Absolutely.
For some reason, I was at the station, right? And I think it was Carletta Joy Walker was on the air.
Oh, my God. There is a name I have not heard in years. I liked her.
From some reason, Emmanuel Goldstein was at the station, right? And Tom Whisker was about to come on, okay? So those are only four people who were at the station. This is 505, right?
Yeah.
Somehow, I think it was Tom guy was, I don't know how he got it, because the newsroom, everything was locked. For some reason, they locked all the doors. Somehow we found out that the U.S. was invading, you know, Panama. And so... Since I just come from, somehow we broke into the newsroom. We broke into the newsroom. Emmanuel Goldstein, as was the one those days, somehow he hacked the phones and got a line to Panama, right? And then what happened was since I had just been there, I had a contact with the hotel guy. So we were on the air live with the hotel guy as they were invading.
I actually remember this. Yeah.
And then somehow we jerry-rigged to edit from the news to edit B, because we was on his phone. We couldn't break the line, because if we broke the line, I would put down Philip Tobanco. He's doing Malumbo music, and it's gonna be, he's very spiritual music, and it's gonna.
It was hard to actually bring him up for some reason, but now we got him.
But we jerry-rigged the thing, because we had to get a line to the phone in the newsroom, because we couldn't switch or something like that, because we'd have lost the line. If we'd have lost the line, then we'd have been severed. We couldn't get it back for some weird technological reason, you know. But as long as we maintained the line open, we could interview. So we get to edit B, and then we pass it on to the main control room. And so that's – so us four, think about it. Think about it, for lack of a better term, a hacker. Let's call me whatever I was, I guess an engineer, you know, Carletta Joy Walker, feel good, you know, airy fairy, and the weaponry guy. We were the first to break this story. And then later on, Robert Knight, the news team, came in, and we go, oh, yeah, the experts here, see you all later.
Yeah.
but, But that's the kind of thing that was
fascinating. And they're going to get all the credit,
We didn't care. In fact, that's the thing. It was interesting. What I learned from Emanation, what I learned from Bernard was this. We used to do this thing. Because, you know, we had Mamiya on the air when he was a reporter for DF. When he was reporting Philadelphia, when he was reporting the move thing, that's when we had Mamiya on the air. Mm-hmm. But the thing I learned from Bernard when I was with Emanations is that
he's written science fiction. You're aware of that.
Say it again?
Mumia.
What about
has written science fiction?
No,
Mumia has a close friend who's been on the show any number of times, named Terry Bisson.
Oh yeah, Terry Bisson. Oh yeah.
How do you know Terry Bisson?
No, I know that the Fire on the Mountain or something like that.
I read that story.
I read that book, the story.
How do you know him?
I like that. Well, I just know that I know the name. I know the story. I like that story. Fire on the Mountain.
Terry, when he lived in the East Coast, was not only a regular on this show, but he would, I won't say show up uninvited, because that sounds like I didn't want him to be here, but he would show up actually at my front door with his car. This is a guy who's into car culture, you know, Kentucky. Mm. He loves driving. And so he would just be at my front door as I would leave the house, ready to drive me into the station. And not only that, but he had this grand old house in Brooklyn, and he would very often have different writers, you know, who are looking for a place to crash, would come to his place to crash. And it would be, Friday night, and he would say, listen, we're going to stay awake. I'm going to take you to a place, and you'll be on the radio. And he would drive them to my house and introduce me to somebody who might be one of my favorite writers who I'd never met, drive us to the station. Mm-hmm. I'd have this person on the air. Terry wouldn't say a word. Mm. Well, no, I take that back. Very often, Terry would say a word and then drive us back. And so Bisson was very much a part. Bisson is an interesting guy. First of all, he's a brilliant satirist and a brilliant writer. You've read one of his novels, but I maintain that his genius is in his short stories. Mm. And I think he will be remembered that way. More for his short stories than anything else. And Bisson largely helped start. I have the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Bisson had started the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, which is held at the KGB Bar. Today it's run by Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel, who came to our reading last night, by the way. And I would attend their readings, except they're on Wednesday nights. Mm. It's very hard for me to do both.
Yeah.
But Gordon Lindsner, who was the magazine he founded and is now run by Hildy Silverman, the reading event we had last night was the 50th anniversary of his magazine. Mm. But a lot of this ties into Terry Bisson, who's he was a very major part of this program for quite a while. Mm. But he moved back to San Francisco, where I think Terry was one of the diggers before there was hippies.
Mm.
There were diggers.
I've heard of that.
And Terry is actually believes in separatism, in black separatism, in black nationalism, in the whole Huey Newton kind of thing. And he's a friend of Mumia's.
Yeah.
And he got Mumia writing science fiction.
Well, one of the things that I learned, like I said, I was learning from Bernard.
I'd bring that story home somewhere.
That's a good story. Well, was basically that we would be doing a story, but soon as it would hit the mainstream, so to speak, or the semi-mainstream, then we say, okay, that's done. What's the next thing? So we go on to the next thing. So we was always fresh, always breaking stuff. That's, you know, breaking news, breaking stuff. And that to me is what we do best. We're not supposed to, you know, when something big hits, we're not supposed to then put our spin on it. That's not the job of BAI. We don't spin. You know, we're there before we're there with the germination and the creation, and as soon as it hits, we're gone. You know, we're on to the next thing, and everybody else, then the mainstream or whatever, the lamestream, whatever they call it, they can take it, and that's it. So that's I'm exhausted with these kind of stories. I'm chomping at the bit. I want to get to one of my favorite scripts. My favorite.
Well, why don't we listen to some of this music for a little while? Yeah, take a break and breathe. Get ourselves a glass of let's water. Do that.
This is a Malumbo. It's called Malumbo music, from Dr. Philip Tabang, and it's a spiritual music. It's amazing music from South Africa. Beautiful. Yeah,
and this cut is Katalango. This is WBAI, New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, where other producers at WBAI are aware of the fact that the capital of Vermont is Montpelier and not Burlington after all. But hey, I said I was tired and all that. We were at Goddard College, which was, inches outside of Montpelier. But hey, it was 1977, just after 39 years ago.
It's kind of interesting. You remember, we had from when I came to BA, we had only two rules. Only two rules. One, no physical fighting at the station. And two, you could not knowingly lie on the air. Those are the only two rules.
Yeah, the first rule is still semi-enforced. The second rule is sort of forgotten in some ways.
I live by codes.
Yeah.
I still live by that code. Oh, yeah, let me put my headphones
on. Now, we are not properly rehearsed. This is new material for me, so
now, there you go.
You will forgive the performance. But, hey, I don't even come in until page two.
But no, you're on page one.
Who are the...
Excuse me, the zebra is on page one. And the Bobono's on page
God,
one, too.
Oh, my God, I'm the zebra also.
And also the Bobono. Let me tell you what this is.
I didn't mark it properly.
You better mark it. I'll introduce it somehow. This is a tale from traditional stories of the Basutu people. Now, the Basutu people, they exist. They're mainly known from Lesotho, the country that is surrounded by South Africa. they're hill people, but they also exist in Swaziland and Botswana and of course South Africa. It's a regional. These false borders, but the people run around anyway. They speak a language called Sotho, and they're the Basutu people. That's the name of the folks. Anyways, this is a traditional Basutu tale. It's called Why Ostrich Has a Long Neck. Okay, let me pronounce it correctly. And it's adapted to audio drama by moi. My name when I adapt these things is called Brother Anthony Sloan. And this is one of 61 autochthonous tales that I adapted. 61, count them, 61 autochthonous tales that I adapted from these traditional stories. Maybe at the end I'll tell you how that came to be. Mm-hmm. And this one, it features the voices of the narrator, which I'm playing the narrator, the ostrich, I'm going to play the ostrich also. The crocodile is going to be played by one Jim Freund. The zebra, they say zebra, you say zebra.
Yeah, and the English say zebra also,
So the zebra.
I think only Americans say zebra.
Well, I'm going to keep on saying zebra, if you don't mind.
I'm good with that.
By Jim. Jim is also playing the giraffe. Anthony, that would be me. I'm playing the wildebeest. And Jim is also playing the bonobo. I will explain these animals afterwards. But you're the...
Tell me a little bit. I don't know the bonobo. Tell me a little bit about the bonobo.
Okay. We know the ostrich. We know the crocodile. We know the zebra. We know the giraffe. We know the wildebeest, which Jim insists its only function of the wildebeest is to feed other animals.
It would seem. It's to migrate, and it migrates because everywhere it goes, it feeds. Everything feeds off of the wildebeest, and I can't figure out what other function the wildebeest, and they eat grass, you know, they're not really feeding upon other things. Wildebeest, which are, I guess, a form of cattle.
Well, they like pigs. They like hogs. You know, they got the tusk like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They're
in a group
hogs.
They can be fearsome, absolutely. Yeah, for the most part, they're there to be run down by big cats and snapped at by crocodiles.
There you are. And the bonobo is, I guess, it's the closest, I guess we call it chimpanzee family. It's actually the closest chimp to the human being.
Okay, so it's an ape.
Yeah, it's an ape. Yes, it's a small ape.
Okay.
And it exists in Southwest Africa, mainly, like DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, that area, you know, and down there. But they're known, the bonobo is known because they basically are the champion boinkers. They negotiate everything through boinking. They constantly boink. That's what they do.
You know, and what's the boink of all that?
Let's just letting you know.
So they communicate through boinking.
Every day that's what they do. That's all I can tell you. Look it up.
Where humans use boinking to not communicate.
Well, for humans, boinking is war.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Absolutely.
It's war.
Absolutely. There's a great story by James Tiptree Jr. about that we can talk about later.
If we have time, we're running out
of time. Well, off the air if needs be, but okay. I have to tell you about that story because it's a great, great
but
story.
But they are fascinating chimps, and they're spelled B-O-N-O-B-O, bonobo. Okay, so that's it. So I adapted it. We have sound effects and music. Don't worry, we're going to be rough with this.
Sort of.
You know, so we'll be rough with it. Don't worry about it. I did perform at one time with some international students, just as a function. We were just having some fun a few months ago. But it's one of my favorite adapted stories, mainly because I adapted the heck out of it. Let's put it that way. This is not how the story originally, if you see the regular story, you look at it and say, ooh, he really did some work with this. So here we go. Yeah, anytime you're ready, you want to start with the music, we can do that and bring it down. Long, long ago, ostrich looked just like other animals.
I did. I didn't know that.
Of course you wouldn't know. And you know why you wouldn't know?
No. Why wouldn't I know something as important as that, Zebra? It seems to me my long ago folks would have told me something about something like this.
I'll let Giraffe explain it to you, as it's rather philosophical, and I can only give you explanations that are strictly black or white, so to speak. Giraffe has a better overview, don't you, Giraffe? Well, it is true I see things more from the overview kind of perception.
That may be true, but I know what happened as I am closer to the ground and was closer to the abuse.
Abuse? What kind of abuse? What are you talking about here?
Wildebeest is being somewhat dramatic.
I know. And how would you know, Bonobo? You weren't anywhere near.
I was close enough. And anyway, why are we listening to this narrator person? What did they know? Never saw no such animal in the bush.
Look, you animals, I'm just here to tell the story to help with history.
It's fine with me if we get your perspective. But we should all stick around to hear what you tell other narrators. Yeah, to make sure you don't muddy up the facts, so to speak.
If you wish. Now, can I get on with the explanation or just what happened, please?
By all means.
Sure, go right ahead. Thank you. Ostrich back then, long, long ago, had a short neck and lived near the river.
I had a short neck.
Yes, you did.
And you live near the river. Her best friend was Crocodile.
Did someone call me? I knew this was going to happen. No, Crocodile, no one called you.
You just stay on that side of the river.
Yeah, we don't need you anywhere near us.
I do agree with Bonobo. I don't get good feelings about seeing this crocodile. The other animals did not trust Crocodile. But way back then, Ostrich did not listen as they warned.
Crocodile is crafty.
Crocodile is cruel.
Ostrich, your head is in the sand, so to speak. Crocodile can never be trusted. Oh, is this that fable about me and Ostrich? I can tell you, with certainty, it was all a very big misunderstanding.
That is terrible.
Really?
My bad, wrong page. Crocodile was her friend. Really?
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 Yes, really. One day, Crocodile was feeling very hungry.
That's no big deal. I'm always hungry. Never hungry. Narrator said very hungry. Very hungry.
I would say even extremely hungry.
How would you know? You're not me. You haven't caught anything to eat in a few days, I bet. Quite a few days indeed.
All the animals were careful not to go near the river where Crocodile lived.
We knew Crocodile would catch and eat us.
That's true.
How do you know what is true or not?
Okay, that's it. Every creature needs to just shut their traps. In fact, here it is. What I'm going to do is, everyone is going to be transported back to that time long ago to observe what really happened.
Can you do that?
Not only will I just do that, but you will all assume the roles of your ancestors without the knowledge you have right now. Hold on to your skins. One day, long, long ago, Crocodile was feeling very hungry. Crocodile came upon his friend Ostrich.
Hello, Ostrich.
Hi, my friend Crocodile.
I need your help.
Oh, what's wrong, Crocodile?
I have a terrible, terrible toothache,
said Crocodile, looking as miserable as possible.
But the problem is, I don't know which tooth is aching.
That is terrible.
Won't you please put your head into my mouth to see which tooth looks bad?
All right, agreed Crocodile, who was always very, very helpful. Now open your jaws as wide as you can. I can't see anything, any problem with the tooth yet. Ostrich was bent down, looking carefully at each and every tooth. All of a sudden, everything went dark. Ostrich could hardly breathe. Slowly, Crocodile began to pull Ostrich into the water, wanting to drown and eat Ostrich. But Ostrich stuck strong legs into the mud, pulling very, very hard. Crocodile was also pulling very, very hard. Ostrich's neck began to stretch and stretch and stretch and stretch. After a while, Crocodile felt very tired because of the lack of food for many days, was weak. Crocodile needed a short rest. Crocodile's mouth opened as a deep breath was needed. With that breath, Ostrich's head popped out. As fast as possible, Ostrich jumped out of the mud and used her long, powerful legs to run up the hill to a place where Crocodile could not follow. I have learned my lesson, said Ostrich to the other animals.
We told you to take care.
Told you Crocodile was no friend.
Yeah, we told you so. A hard head makes for a long neck, so to speak.
I shall never trust Crocodile again. In fact, I shall never go near the river again. Ostrich gathered up her belongings and left for the sandy place where there would be no rivers or crocodiles. To this day, Ostrich, with a long, stretched neck, chooses friends very, very carefully. That was a reading of Why Ostrich Has a Long Neck from Traditional Tales of the Basotho People, adapted by Brother Anthony Sloan. And the music you're listening to is Dr. Philip Tabang with Malumbo music.
And if you want to look it up, it's T-A-B-A-N-E, Tabang. One L in Philip, by the way.
He's a beautiful musician.
I
met him because I had an association with it for 5 years with a thing called Pan African Space Station. We do this live intervention every year for a month. We have live artists for one when we put with that whole month. We all kinds of musicians would come through, and I was like it was a weird thing. I was like the engineer, also production engineer, and it was a very challenging thing. But I won't get into it. But it was like one of the most challenging things in my life, and it was very, very rewarding. I met some fantastic African musicians, some fantastic African music, and it was just a wonderful time in Cape Town.
What is it about Africa that it just seems to be a magnet for some of the best music, Western, Eastern, Asian, whatever, and it seems to come to Africa to synthesize, and then once again, once there, once it has somehow transmuted in Africa, it is shared with the world in a new form. That's at least my take. I think that's...
Well, I can't... I'm not a musician, so I can't speak as a musician, okay? I'm more of maybe a social scientist, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There was a freedom fighter in South Africa. His name is Mangalisa Robert Sobukwe. He's this in the late 50s, early 60s. In fact, he was so dangerous. He's the one that started the Sharpeville Massacre because he told people to burn their passbooks. He was so dangerous to the regime, that apartheid, the evil apartheid regime, that when they put him on Robben Island, he was in isolation. No one could speak to him, not even his guard. He had a separate housing thing. This is how
like the African version of the man in the Iron Mask. Yeah, too dangerous.
Amazing.
Yeah.
When he finally let him out, they exiled him to a bunch of things happened. Anyway, he graduated from the university I go to right now, University of Fort Hare. But this guy was uncompromising. He was this principled. But one of the things he said that resonates to this day is to be African is to be humane.
Mm.
Now, if you really look at it, all those folks that's coming, the French with their little bauxite or whatever, having the people with their coltan, with all the resources they're trying to rape out of Africa, these are inhumane acts. Not just they don't pay people fairly or whatever have you. It's just that they do it in such an inhumane way.
Yeah.
You see? I think that there's a what's called cosmology. There's a spirituality that African people, when I say African people all over the world, have to their detriment, but what they have. And when you rip that cosmology or you alter it like Western religions do, like Christianity, for instance, or even Islam does, when they rip it and then they convince Africans to take on that, I won't say the Africans lose their soul, but they lose something. So I think that musicians and even the church people, they are closer to that humanity. That music brings them closer to that humanity, closer to that cosmology. This is I don't have any proof of this. I'm just saying this. Like this. And I think that's what it is. I think the further you get away from Africa, the further you get away from that cosmology. Now remember, the African societies, ways of working, predates all of this stuff. You know, even everybody goes to Egypt. Well, you know, they go to the Greeks, but the Greeks got their stuff from Egypt. But where did Egypt get their stuff from? From the interiors of Africa.
Yeah.
You see, it's just that Egypt, because it has desert on both sides, things were preserved better in Egypt. But that stuff had to come. Remember, the Nile flows up. So if you go from Lake Victoria, if you will, well, whatever the lake real's name is, and then it goes up like that. All the stuff goes there. So it sort of gets preserved and gets distilled from the crossroads that is Egypt or that area. But if you go, Uganda, all this, DRC, all these things. Think of the DRC, for instance. I mean, my goodness, they have everything. The poor people, every time something
DRC
happens, the Democratic Republic of Congo. They just get beat on. First it's rubber, and then it's something else, then it's the trees, then it's the gorillas, then it's the coltan. It's like they never get a break, you know.
Yeah.
If I wanted to stop war right now, you know what I would do? I just go to the DRC and say, brothers, here's what we're going to do. No more fighting. We're going to suspend the coltan. This means no more cell phones, no more computers, no more drones, no more nothing until everybody gets their humanity back. It's as simple as that. So anyway, I don't want to get into it, but
it's a nice thought, and this is the kind of thing that, getting to the general topic of this program, this is what science fiction does. When I say science fiction, the story people just heard is within the genre. It's imaginative literature is what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And this is what it provides, is the way to say, okay, what happens to a world in which people actually did what you just say, got rid of their cell phones and got rid of this and got rid of that. And that's what leads you towards some of the great literature of the modern era of science fiction writing, people who you did not find in the genre 30, 40 years ago, like N.K. Jemisin and Elijah Dawn Johnson and Kim Stanley Robinson and all these people with three names. There are new voices out there that are using the old traditions. And even if we take that, you know, why ostrich's neck is so long, that leads us to the Just So stories, doesn't it? Mm. I assume this is the source for Kipling's Just So stories, how the leopard got its spots.
I have a story about that, how leopard got its spots.
Does all
these animal tales, they're all there. I have 61 adapted tales.
Out of how many? There must be. There must be more than that. And this is from the, it's spelled Basotho, but how do you say it?
Basotho. Basotho. Yeah, they speak a language called Sotho. They name them. They come from their homeland, if you will. It's a mountain range called Lesotho. The Lesotho people. Lesotho people. It's surrounded by South Africa. You can look at the map. You have Swaziland on one side, and you have South Africa. Then Lesotho is right in the middle. Botswana is up north, and it's all that whole region there.
Yeah,
like that.
And now there's some science fiction and fantasy literature finally coming from Africa. Before that, it was American writers and other writers writing about Africa, but now stuff is starting. Then came the book Dark Matter.
Tell me about
Sheree Renee Thomas.
Say her name again?
Sheree Renee Thomas.
I've got to get that.
And
book.
That is the Dark Matter. The full title is A Century of Speculative Literature from the African Diaspora.
Let me see your pen for a second. Let's throw your pen over here.
Yeah, here it is. And this is now available in ebook form.
How you spell her first name?
S-H-E-R-E-E.
E-R-E-E. Ah, Sheree.
Renee. Thomas. Thomas. Everybody at home, take note. This is one of the most important books in science fiction ever, period, bar none. For many, many reasons.
We don't have time, because we're out of time. But I want to say one last thing about Africa. Professor James Small, who I just interviewed, I'll put his thing up on YouTube sooner or later, he insists that human beings is like, the human state is God having a human experience.
Ooh.
Which is the African come out. Is God having a human experience? Which explains a lot in my book.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Africa is. And as you try to destroy Africa, you're trying to destroy your godly experience.
And that is quite a note to bear in mind as we go into the various conventions that are going to determine who's going to rule this country and therefore have profound effects upon the rest of the world, including Africa. But that's a great thought to go out on. Thank you, Anthony J. Sloan.
Look, it was a privilege, an honor. You have no idea, Jim. This
so
is like
fun.
Amazing because I've listened to you for years telling stories and stuff like that. I just love
you. You were
your
my
program.
Boss here, man.
Sure.
Arts director. I was in the arts department. You know,
I never tried to rule anybody. I just tried
no,
to
you
help
never
them.
Did.
I just tried to help people.
But a director You know, so, okay, you weren't my boss. You were the person I looked up to. One way or the other, by the way, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. You can visit the group on Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group. There is now an audiobook available called Chatting Science Fiction. And, well, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that you might just be able to get a copy at some point if you were to support this radio station. But we're working on how to make that happen. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming over these airwaves as soon as I shut the bleep up. And in the meantime, everybody, be good to each other. I don't know exactly when I'll be back. I suspect in 3 weeks as we wind down our fundraising drive. And I may be on a special here or there, but not necessarily here, but on WBAI. Again, stay tuned, and thanks for listening, and thank you, Anthony. Everybody, have a wonderful time. Good morning.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to spell it. I am a proletarian. I am
the
fiction.
Red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Hey. Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central, LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. You flag America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Bye. father's house. Where there is many a mansion in my father's house. Oh, na na na, oh, in my father's house. Where there is many a mansion in my father's house. This world is I came. Yeah, that is the way. My mother gave life to I. Then if I not search through time and space, all my life it would have gone to waste right here in my father's house. Where there is many a mansion in my father's house. Virgins to the wedding, they came that day. Yeah, oil in the lamp. That was the question. Five of them were wise. Five of them were foolish. Now five left out the door. Anyhow, I say, would I tell you so? In my father's house.
Tell you, so in my father's house.